Selling Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. Now, it's time to go deep for the exclusive info you need on the hockey team you love. This is Preds Insiders with your host, Ryan Porth.
Brought to you by Dr. Kelly Rice, Family Cosmetic and Dental Sleep Medicine, Wyatt Johnson Ford, Geno's East, Downtown Nashville, and OsteoStrong Nashville.
On your flagship home of the Predators Radio Network, Smashville's best sports talk,
ESPN
102.5 The Game.
Welcome into this Wednesday edition of Preds Insiders here on ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming on the Game Nashville app. Ryan Porth here with you, alongside Adam Vingan of The Athletic. Adam, how are we doing?
I am good, Ryan. How are you?
Pretty good. Good to see you.
Always a pleasure.
Now, before we get into what happened with the Preds and the Coyotes in the qualifier round, the water cooler talk as it pertains to the Stanley Cup playoffs in the last, 20 hours has been the fact that it took 20 hours for the Blue Jackets and the Tampa Bay Lightning to complete Game 1, which lasted over 150 minutes of gameplay,
mm-hmm,
and into the fifth overtime before Braden Point won it for the Tampa Bay Lightning. I can't remember staying up or watching a longer hockey game than that one.
Well, fortunately, the game started in the afternoon. I believe it was a 3:30 Eastern game. Imagine if that game would have started at 7 and it lasted until
midnight
or 1 o'clock in the morning. So I appreciate those two teams, I guess the NHL, for having the foresight to put them in the afternoon slot just in case they happen to play one of the longest games in NHL history. I also like the fact that the Bruins and Hurricanes were basically told to go home and just say, we'll come back tomorrow.
We don't know when this game is going to end. Yes. Just come back tomorrow.
And of course, that game was played earlier today, this morning, the Bruins winning.
Patrice Bergeron with the winner, and they go to double overtime. So fitting that they got bumped to today because of overtime, and then they play double overtime.
Yes,
earlier today. So,
but a great game, of course. Seth Jones playing the most minutes ever recorded.
It felt like he played 120 of the 150 minutes. It at least felt like that.
He was out there a lot. I believe the previous record was close to 62 minutes by Sergei Zubov in 2004 or 2003. I can't remember.
I think that was 04.
So Seth Jones obliterated that record with his performance yesterday. And I'm just impressed with, you know, the stamina that these players have. Look, we could tell as the games were going on that legs were getting heavier, players were a bit slower. But the level of play was still high overall, which made the game incredibly captivating.
How would you put the first week of play into words, or first week and a half of what we've seen, given the uniqueness of it in the bubble cities, Edmonton, Toronto, no fans, day games, night games, what have you?
I think it's been great. I think the wall-to-wall hockey from early afternoon until late in the evening sort of has that first weekend of the NCAA men's basketball tournament feel to it, which is one of my favorite days, 2 days of the sports calendar under normal circumstances are the first two days of the NCAA tournament, when there are games starting at 11 a.m. and you can watch basketball all day until midnight. And when one game's at commercial, you can flip on another game. And when that game's at halftime, you can flip on another game. So I think that's been great. I think the NHL has done a great job with the presentation of the games, not taking themselves too seriously as well, which I appreciate. And I just think, you know, a lot of the games have been entertaining. I mean, every series, I feel like you can count at least one game of each qualifying series, if not more, that were very entertaining. Some more than others, of course. But I think it's been, to use a mixed analogy, a home run for the National Hockey League in terms of what they've been able to produce so far.
I love their message last night on the Jumbotron during the Lightning and Jackets game of, we're sorry if you had other plans tonight.
Yeah, I like the one where it was, you know, please, you know, have, you know, thank you for coming, please exit your couch safely or something like that. I appreciate the dad humor that's been all over the place.
Tonight's attendance, 0.
or the thank you to the best fans, and it's four fans.
Love it.
Yes.
Love it. So, yes, I would agree. The action in Edmonton and Toronto has been very, very good compared to what we may have thought earlier this summer when they first rolled out the format. And speaking of that, earlier this summer we first learned that the Preds were going to take on the Arizona Coyotes in the qualifier series, and I think a lot of people just expected the Preds to get through that series and beat the Arizona Coyotes because they were the higher seed. They had the better regular season going into the season pause. On paper, they were better, but none of that came to fruition last week in that four-game series in which the Coyotes won the best of five to move on to this qualifier series where they'll take on the Colorado Avalanche. And Adam, just wanted to get you, before we kind of get into what some of the players have said after the series, wanted to get your thoughts on how that series unfolded for the Nashville Predators.
I remember before the series started being on air with Jared, and we received a text from a listener who said, you know, if I'm a Predators fan, what should I be worried about in this series? And it was a broad question. It could be related to the Predators. It could be related to the Coyotes. I took the Coyotes stance. And I said, if I'm a Predators fan, two things that concern me about the Coyotes, if I were in your shoes, would be one, that Darcy Kemper demonstrates why he was among the best goaltenders in the league during the regular season when he was healthy. And two, that the Coyotes' top offensive players, namely Taylor Hall and Phil Kessel, figure it out after less than stellar regular seasons and have great postseasons, at least a great series. And I think both of those things came true, much to the chagrin of the Predators. I thought Darcy Kemper was great. Was he perfect? No, but I thought he made the saves he needed to make throughout most of the series. I thought Taylor Hall and Phil Kessel were solid. They contributed in more ways than one offensively. So I think it was almost like a nightmare scenario for the Predators a little bit. And the Coyotes are a stingy defensive team. You know, outside of game two, I feel like the Predators didn't really have much. And, you know, I'm not sure if I would go as far as to say that it was a bad matchup for the Predators, but a lot of people picked the Coyotes to win that series. I mean, it wasn't a shock to a lot of people that the Predators lost that series. I thought they would win that series. It even said so on the billboard at McDonald's on West End Avenue. They're never going to put my name up there again. But I just look at the series and feel like the players do, that they were much more competitive than they were last year against Dallas. But it's hard to reconcile that with the fact that this team continues to move backward in the postseason. So, and we'll get into this a little bit more later, but, you know, great, they were more competitive. They still lost in four games. So I don't think you can take any moral victories out of that.
Well, let's get to what one of the players had to say today in their media availability. Nick Bonino was asked about the fact that they did outplay the Arizona Coyotes, or the thought that they outplayed the Coyotes, and how do you balance that with also realizing the fact that they lost in four games despite outplaying their opponent. And that is on the heels of Ryan Ellis essentially saying Friday afternoon that he was proud of the team's effort despite losing in four games. And here's what Nick Bonino had to say.
You know, I think him saying that, and I spoke with him about it, you know, after we lost to Dallas, you can ask these guys, it was pretty silent, pretty dejected locker room. I think we weren't happy at all with how we'd played. We deserved what we got. And, you know, we knew a lot of things had to change. I think this year, just watching the series as a fan, as media, as coaches, and looking back as players, I think, you know, we showed up, we played hard. We had a better system. Everybody individually played better than we did last year. So it's definitely easier to be proud of it. But like Yo said, you know, a loss is a loss. It's maybe at the beginning of the year when you're going through, you know, the first 10, 20 games, moral victories are okay. You know, you play well, but you lose, you know, it's going to come around, and that stings in the playoffs because we ran out of time. So obviously we missed something. It wasn't enough what we did, but I think we're all happier with how we played, but obviously not happy with the end result.
So that was Nick Bonino earlier today in the Nashville Predators player availability. Adam, what did you make of what Nick had to say there?
I understand where he's coming from, and I go back to what Ryan Ellis said, which we were alluding to, about this idea that, to paraphrase, there is a new sense of belief and pride in the dressing room, and that the Predators felt better about their game in this series than they did against the Stars last year, and even Ryan Ellis went back to 2 years ago against the Avalanche and the Jets, and it's important for them to feel that way, right? You want them to feel like there's something to build on inside that dressing room, but I feel like the timing of Ryan Ellis's sentiment could not have been worse. I think after that game, fans wanted to see a little bit more anger, a bit more dissatisfaction. Not to say that the Predators were pleased to the point that it didn't matter that they lost, because clearly they were not happy that they lost and were eliminated from the qualifying round. But I just think that may have played a bit better today than it did 5 days ago when they lost.
Right.
And I think Ryan Ellis took a lot of heat for that. I certainly gave him some. And again, it's good that the players feel that way, but that's going to be a tough sell to those of us that are not in that dressing room who watch this team on a daily basis, whether it's you and I or fans or whomever. I don't think after so many disappointing showings in the postseason that you can say that and sell that to your fan base, because at this point they're PO'd.
Right. Well, I know for myself, I've been frustrated watching this team really since the turn of the calendar year to 2019. And ever since then, this team has been topsy-turvy, never know what to expect night to night. And to hear Ryan Ellis say that, I said this with Jeremy K. Gover the other night on Monday's edition of Preds Insiders, that it felt like moral victory talk, and that was not the time or the place to have the moral victory talk. It just wasn't.
No, it wasn't. And look, and we'll get into this more, I'm sure, because we have a lot of time on our hands now. But it's going to be interesting to see exactly what the Predators do and where they go from here. Because, of course, the team wants to come back and be together again, as they've said over the past several years. But how many times can they do this and expect a different result and our patience?
Let's pause right there and pick this conversation up on the other side, because we all know changes need to be made. But how significant do these changes need to be made for the Nashville Predators to take the next step and get back going in the right direction starting next season? That's all coming up next here on Preds Insiders. He's Adam Fink, and I'm Ryan Porth. You're listening to ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming on the Game Nashville app. Welcome back into Preds Insiders, ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming on the Game Nashville app. Preds Insiders brought to you every week by Dr. Kelly Rice. Go to kellyerice.com. Nashville's number one Ford dealer, Wyatt Johnson Ford. Geno's East on the corner of 3rd Avenue and Korean Veterans Boulevard in downtown Nashville. And OsteoStrong, Nashville. Ryan Porth alongside Adam Vinken of The Athletic here on this Wednesday evening, coming up at 7:15 this evening. Coverage of Nashville SC's return to the pitch against FC Dallas. That will be heard on both 102.5 The Game and ESPN 94.9. So stay tuned for that here in just a little bit, in just about an hour. Adam, we kind of started going down this road last segment of the changes that need to be made for this Nashville Predators team and whether or not those changes need to involve the core of this team that has been together for quite some time now. And Philip Forsberg earlier today was asked about his confidence in this core remaining together and having success. And here's what Philip Forsberg had to say.
When you look at most successful teams, there's obviously a group of guys that's driving the bus, and you're always going to need, you've seen so many times in different playoffs, especially there's always going to be those unsung heroes that steps up and plays their best hockey at the right time. But over time, obviously it's the core group of guys that's going to be leading the team. And I believe 100% that we have the right guys in that spot. And obviously just talking about myself, it's been more of a challenge. Obviously there's a challenge being one of those guys and being counted on, but that's something that I put a lot of thought into over, especially over the quarantine break here, and just personally trying to, like I said, put in more for the team and just being more reliable to my teammates. And I thought the playoffs was a step in the right direction for me personally in that aspect. And obviously it's going to be a big challenge for me individually to be one of those guys. And like I said, I think everybody else has been definitely doing a good job with Roman leading the way as the captain and setting the example. So I definitely think we have the right group of guys. And like you said, changes is with the salary cap and everything is probably going to happen at some point. But like you said, the main guys are have been the same for a while. And as of right now, it doesn't look like that's going to change. I really believe in that.
That was Philip Forsberg earlier this afternoon speaking with the media for the first time since Friday's loss to the Arizona Coyotes in Game 4, the best of 5. Adam, what's kind of your thought on the players continuing to preach that they like the core that they have, that they're confident in each other, that they can get the job done after 3 straight postseasons of going in the wrong direction when it comes to results in the postseason?
Well, certainly we don't expect them to say anything other than that. I don't think you're ever going to hear a player say, well, I feel like we need to blow it up. It was a good try.
When have we ever heard a player say that?
Exactly. So I didn't expect a different answer from Philip Forsberg or anybody who was asked that question or is asked that question, because the players are always going to default to, we believe in the players on this team, yada, yada, yada. But when you look at the makeup of this team, when you look at their salary cap situation, they're in a really tough spot because there aren't too many outs that they have. For example, they do have some in the sense that they have, I believe, 6 pending unrestricted free agents on their roster. So you can move on from Mikhail Granlund. You can move on from Craig Smith if you want to. You can move on from Dan Hamhuis or Yannick Weber or Corbinian Hultzer. You can re-sign Colin Blackwell to a league minimum deal because I thought he was a nice depth addition to this team during the season. And you can fill those holes with youth, which they absolutely need to, whether it's Ellie Tolvanen or Philip Tomasino or Alex Carrier. I think you need that. This team needs to get younger. But the idea that they are going to be able to swing a big trade like they did last summer, trading PK Subban to free up the cap space to sign Matt Duchene, I'm not sure how available that is going to be just because of the cap situation around the league. The cap, as we know, is staying flat. It will remain $81.5 million next season after it was projected before the league shut down to be anywhere between $84 and $88 million. So that's a big difference. So would I be surprised if the Predators came back next season mostly the same, minus swapping out those unrestricted free agents for youth players on entry-level contracts? I wouldn't be entirely shocked. The problem is, and herein lies the problem for the Predators, it's going to be a very difficult sell to their fan base to bring most of this team back. It is much easier said than done to blow it up, to use my previous phrase. But I feel like if this team were to return mostly intact next season, I think, and this might be too strong of a word, but you might see some fan revolt just based on the conversations I've had with fans on social media.
Well, they do have the $9.2 million in cap space going into the offseason. But it's not like this free agency class is oozing a bunch of talent.
Right.
I mean, there's Taylor Hall, and then at forward, where you would think that they'd be more likely to spend money in free agency, there aren't a whole lot of attractive names after that, especially fitting a need in which this team they just flat out need to get grittier, they need to get tougher, they need to have a roster better suited for the playoffs than they have right now.
Yes.
And if they do the things that you're talking about of letting the free agents go, Granlund, Smith, on defense, Hamhuis, Hulser, Weber, it's not like, A, that there's free agents out there that you feel like you can go out and sign and plug into those roles and feel better about your roster going into the 2021 season than you did in this Arizona series. So that's one obstacle. Another one is if you're going to make a trade, you're either trying to go out and get somebody that's going to cost you assets, and David Poile doesn't have many assets to deal with, even though he stocked the cupboard a little better last offseason than it looked going into the offseason. You're either dealing from that cupboard, or you're dealing for somebody who is needing a change of scenery or has a cap hit that the other team is trying to get rid of, and you don't want another player like that on your roster because you have enough players on this roster that have too high of a cap hit, i.e. Kyle Turris.
I think of the trade made last summer between the Oilers and Flames, James Neal for Milan Lucic. That's not the kind of trade you want to make right now. You don't want to trade a Kyle Turris, for example, to another team who has a player in the same position, a veteran player who costs a lot, who's not performing. And sometimes the change of scenery does work, but that's not the kind of trade I feel like the Predators should be making at this point. And you're right, the free agency class is not brimming with can't-miss names, but you know, it is going to be a very interesting offseason. I'm very curious to see how management tries to wiggle their way out of the conundrum that they're in right now.
Well, here's another point that I made with Jeremy K. Gover earlier this week on Monday's edition of Preds Insiders, which was, okay, if you're losing Granlund and Smith, those are two middle six forwards, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Granlund, a second-line player.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to get younger, you're putting a lot of pressure on individuals like maybe an Ellie Tolvanen, maybe a Philip Tomasino, to come right into the NHL and perform to the level that you know Granlund and Smith are capable of if you don't want the offense to take a step back. And if you're going to get younger, then you're banking on that. Because really, the bottom six is pretty set in stone just based on the contracts. Watson, Sissons, Yarncroak, Bonino, Grimaldi. I don't know how much is going to change on that front. So they've kind of painted themselves into a corner, like you mentioned, that there isn't an easy way to even reshuffle the deck, at least offensively.
The kind of player I feel like this team needs, and there are many ways I can describe it, but we are a family show, so I will not use vulgarity. The Predators need a jerk. Look, there are a lot of Predators fans who have a torrid love affair with James Neal. It's been 3 years, people move on. But anyway, they have a torrid love affair with James Neal, and to the credit of those fans who feel that way. The thing about James Neal, and to a similar extent PK Subban, is that they played with an edge. They're jerks on the ice. They're not afraid to mix it up. They're not afraid to speak their mind. They get under their opponent's skin. There is nobody on this Predators roster who does that. You think of the prototypical players like that in the league that you think of. Brad Marchand, Tom Wilson, Matthew Tkachuk, all jerks on the ice in their own right, and perhaps off the ice too, but we're talking on the ice. All jerks on the ice, all willing to get under opponent's skin, but all incredibly effective players, guys who can score 20 to 30 goals and have 50 to 60 points. The Predators need a player like that. Where are they going to find that player? I don't know. But if you're asking me for a mold of a player, if the Predators need one kind of player, what would it be? That's my answer. They need a player like that. I mean, the closest thing they have to that is Austin Watson. And Austin is more than willing to mix it up, but Austin Watson is not the offensive type of player like the ones I mentioned.
Plus, his overall game regressed.
Yes.
This season.
Right. Like, I'm trying to think of other players in the league who fit that mold. Perhaps others can. Max Domi. You know, someone like that.
Sure, but those players are very hard to come by.
Yes.
You usually have to draft that player.
Yes.
And if that player hits free agency, as we've seen in the past, usually it's not good to sign that player in free agency, a power forward or someone who fits that bill, because there's a reason why they hit free agency when you look at David Backus or Andrew Ladd or Milan Lucic, and then their games go down the drain after signing a big contract.
Right, and Wayne Simmons...
Simmons as well.
Wayne Simmons is that kind of player. The problem, of course, is that the Predators got him at the time where his game was starting to slide and he was injured.
They got him 3 years too late.
Yes, but they need a player like that. Like, they need a James Neal type that's in his prime. James Neal is past his prime. No, James Neal is not coming back. Don't make it so.
I mean, when you look at the free agents out there at forward, you're looking at Mike Hoffman. You're looking at
who would not fit the description I'm giving you, but is actually not a bad player to think about as a winger who can actually score.
So you would rather have Hoffman than Granlund or Smith?
Depends on the price.
Sure. I mean,
but Hoffman is more of a sniper than those two are, and that's what the Predators need. Hoffman does not fit the Tom Wilson, Brad Marchand, Matthew Tkachuk mold, but I do actually find him to be quite interesting.
Then you have Tyler Toffoli, Alex Galchenyuk. You've got Vladislav
Namestnikov.
Thank you. Andre Burakovsky, Michael Frolik.
It's a lot of depth guys.
Exactly. A lot of second or third line players that would fit teams that need a little bit more skill and not a little bit more grit, sandpaper,
the
toughness.
Predators don't need, every team could always use more skill, but I feel like the Predators need more sandpaper.
I would totally agree. Coming up next, a big question this offseason as it was last offseason. What should the Predators do about Kyle Turris? That's coming up next. He's Adam Vink and I'm Ryan Porth. You are listening to Preds Insiders, ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming on the Game National app. Welcome back into the show. That's right. Preds Insiders, Ryan Porth alongside Adam Vingan on this Wednesday evening here on ESPN 102.5 The Game, talking Preds offseason as the season came to an end last Friday evening against the Arizona Coyotes in Game 4 of the best-of-five series in the qualifier series. So, Adam, one question that we had going into last offseason after, I guess you could say, the fallout between Kyle Turris and Peter Laviolette late in the regular season, and the fact that Kyle Turris's game really took a nosedive in the 18-19 season, is, yet again, what should the Preds do about Kyle Turris? Because the 19-20 season for Kyle Turris wasn't that much better. He played maybe marginally better under John Hines, but still, I look at Kyle Turris on this roster and say, this guy is like an obstacle. Either you've got three centers on this roster that are best suited for the top two lines, Kyle Turris being one of them. If you put him at second-line center, you're moving Matt Duchene to the wing. If you're putting Kyle Turris on the wing, he's not a fit on the wing. If you put Kyle Turris on the fourth line, he's not a fourth-line player. Square peg, round hole. We've both thought that for quite some time for Kyle Turris in a Preds uniform. Kyle Turris also has 4 years left on his six-year, $36 million contract that he signed upon his arrival to Nashville. So, Adam, in your mind, what are the options for the Nashville Predators as it pertains to Kyle Turris?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I wrote about it
today. Oh, did you?
Yes, on theathletic.com.
And shameless plug.
Yes. And the article is the case for the Predators to buy out Kyle Turris's contract. Because I agree with everything you just said about him being, a square... Was it square peg, round hole?
Yep.
Okay, square peg. I wasn't sure if it's round peg, square hole.
Is it same thing?
Okay.
Really?
The second one doesn't sound as natural. But
no, it doesn't.
Anyway, point being, I give Kyle Turris a lot of credit. I think he's made the best of a difficult situation. It has not been easy, as we know. But when you look at changes this team could make / need to make, moving on from Kyle Turris, I believe, is paramount. And there's the possibility, for example, that you hold on to him for one more year. You hope that under a full season of John Hines, he can find some semblance of his former self, and then hope that next year in the expansion draft that he will have played himself onto the Seattle Kraken. But that's a lot of hoping and wishing. I think it would be prudent for the Predators to buy him out. Now, what would that mean? It would mean that the Predators would have to pay him 2/3 of his remaining salary, which would be $16 million because they owe him $24 million after, you know, for the next 4 years. And they would have to spread that out over twice the remaining amount on his contract. So that means for the next 8 seasons, the Predators would have to carry a $2 million cap hit for Kyle Turris. Now, that's terrifying, just spelling that out. It's terrifying. But think about it this way. We mentioned the cap is staying flat. We don't know how much the cap is going to grow over the next 4 years. It all depends on hockey-related revenue and whether the league can get back to normalcy, if fans are allowed back in the building, all of those things. So the length of the buyout is terrifying, but an extra $4 million in cap space in each of the next 4 years with the cap uncertainty is not an insignificant amount of money. So you hope that by 2024, when his contract would have expired, that the cap has rebounded and that $2 million does not cost as much as it would under these circumstances. I was actually surprised when I did this research that eye test wise, Kyle Turris was a much more effective player under John Hines. But if you dive into his numbers, he actually played worse under John Hines than he did under Peter Laviolette. In terms of points per game average, it was exactly the same. He averaged half a point a game under Peter Laviolette and half a point a game under John Hines. But if you look at some of the fancy stats, they all went down. I just think at this point, Kyle turns 31 on Friday. He's not getting any younger. It's unlikely that his game is going to rebound to a point where he's worth $6 million a year. I think at this point, as difficult as it will be to swallow because of how much the Predators paid to get him, which, of course, he was part of that three-team trade, the Predators had to send Sam Girard, Vladislav Kamenev, and a second-round pick to the Colorado Avalanche as part of that three-team deal that also included Matt Duchene, of course. It's going to be tough to swallow, especially because Sam Girard has turned into a nice player for the Avalanche, who are perhaps the best team in the Western Conference. But I think financially, the way to go is just to cut ties. You tried it. It didn't work. Move on.
You mentioned the freed cap space of $4 extra million, which would obviously be great. I look at it as a depth chart move as well, where you finally have a little bit more breathing room within your roster,
right?
Within John Hines's depth chart, where he now has more flexibility. Where Kyle Turris, you know, I thought you said a lot of great things about him, and it's no disrespect to him as a person, but this last year and a half, honestly, he's kind of felt like dead weight at forward. That you were forced to play him because you're paying him all this money. He's on the roster. You know he has the talent to score goals on any given night, but the fact that he ended up with 9 goals in 62 games this past regular season, 7 goals in 55 games in the 18-19 regular season. He missed some time due to injury that year. I mean, this is a player that had 3 20-plus goal seasons in an Ottawa uniform leading up to him coming over to Nashville. And the first 20 games or so were great. After that, through the end of that first regular season, he was streaky. And then from the start of that 18 postseason against Colorado and Winnipeg, and ever since that point, he just hasn't been what the Predators needed out of him.
To put it into perspective, in the abbreviated season he had with the Predators, so his time with the Predators after the trade in 2017, he had 42 points in 65 games during the regular season. Over the past 2 seasons, he has 54 points in 117 games.
He also has not performed at all in the playoffs.
No, to be fair, he did score a nice goal that Matt Duchene ruined for him. But the point being is that it is, and these are one of those, and this is the challenge sometimes of being in the position that we're in, because I appreciate, you know, the for lack of a better term, the brave face that Kyle Turris put on through all of this, especially when he was being scratched in late November for 7 consecutive games. You know, I have a ton of respect for Kyle Turris, and it wasn't an easy thing to write, but I feel like if this team wants to get back in the right direction, they can't pay. They have enough underperforming players that they're paying too much money. If you have an opportunity to get out from one of them, even if it's going to make you swallow a little bit more money than you want, I think you have to do it. I mean, I just don't see a future for Kyle Turris in Nashville.
And there's also no trade unless you're giving up a valuable asset in addition to Kyle Turris just to get rid of the contract.
Right.
And the Preds can't really afford to get rid of that additional asset, depending on what that asset is.
Yeah, you don't want to, for example, trade Kyle Turris to Team X with a second-round pick and eat half of his salary. Because, yes, the amount of time he's on your cap is smaller. It's 4 years instead of eight. But, you know, this is the way to cut ties with him without having to give up more than you need to. I just think that an extra $4 million in this cap situation can go a long way in improving this team. So it just doesn't make sense to me not to do it. But that's just my opinion.
And that trade is going to go down as David Poyle's worst.
You think so? Because, I mean, I've had this conversation with many people. You know, there are others that precede my time. You know, the one that always comes up is the Franz and Santarelli trade in 2015.
That was bad, but that trade did not set the Preds' cap situation or roster back more than, you know, 20 games. This is a crushing blow both to the salary cap and the fact that you made this trade with a divisional opponent who now has Sam Girard, who you drafted. Sam Girard's turned into a good defenseman for the Avalanche. And now you are facing, if you buy him out, a $2 million cap hit for each of the next eight years, which is just, I mean, that's almost Bobby Bonilla-esque.
Not quite, because the Mets still have to owe him, still have to pay him for like another 50 years, right?
Yes, I exaggerate.
I might be off, give or take, but it feels that way.
It does feel that way. Coming up next, a big storyline in that Arizona series. Will it remain that way? We'll get to that next. He's Adam Vink and I'm Ryan Porth. It's ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into the show, Preds Insiders. ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming on the Game National app. Ryan Porth alongside Adam Vinken of The Athletic here on this Wednesday evening. And Adam, in that four-game series against the Arizona Coyotes, in which the Preds season came to an abrupt end up in Edmonton in the qualifier series. UC Saros started every game and played every single minute between the pipes for the Nashville Predators. And as you had the stat, what was it, 89 consecutive playoff games?
Yes.
That Pecorine started, that came to an end.
Fourth longest streak in NHL history.
That came to an end with UC Saros getting the game one start against Arizona. And he played the entirety of that playoff series. I made the bold prediction on the eve of that series beginning that UC Saros would start and play every single game and that people were overlooking the back-to-back for games two and three because it wasn't your normal back-to-back.
Right.
And I thought if UC Saros did that the Preds would win the series because I thought that would mean UC Saros would be playing at a pretty high level for John Hines not to go to Pecorine. As we all know, UC Saros, I would say I gave him a B-.
As did I.
You did as well. Thought he could have been better, but he wasn't horrible in the series against the Coyotes. He probably wants two or three of those goals back. But when you look at UC Saros and him being the future, because we all know Pecorine, 1 year left on his contract. If UC Saros was John Hines' guy going into the pause, after the pause, you would have to think he's going to be John Hines' guy going into the 2021 season. I think we have to accept the fact that the torch has been passed from Pecorine to UC Saros unless something unexpected happens. So I ask you this question, Adam. What is your confidence level on a scale of 1 to 10 that UC Saros can be the guy for the Nashville Predators and actually play at a high level being the guy?
Well, as I contemplate my answer, the only time I was a bit surprised that Pecorine did not come into the series is when it was 2-0 in game four.
Agreed.
I thought that if there was ever a time that he was going to come in, that would have been the time. Just to switch up the mojo a bit. But John Hines, through thick and thin, has stuck with UC Soros. And I agree, if it wasn't clear before the pause, it's clear now that UC Soros is John Hines' guy in net. So in four games, pardon me while I load the statistics, he had a 322 goals against average and 895 save percentage, which, of course, on their face, are not great numbers. But I will disagree with those who think that his performance in this postseason can then be extrapolated to say that because of his performance in the playoffs, he is not a number one caliber goalie in the NHL. I think that is too far of a stretch to make.
And too soon in his career.
And too soon. I thought UC Soros played a solid series. Was he the difference maker? No. Did he need to be the difference maker more? Yes. Did he cost the Predators their series? No. So I think he had a fine series. It could have been better, but all things considered, I thought it was fine. My confidence level in UC Soros, it's a bit incomplete. To answer your question, 1 through 10, I would at this very moment, I would say a 6. I think his second half was great. I don't think you could have asked for a better second half. And here's something that I do not believe is a stretch. Because I remember doing, right after the season paused, I did an analysis of Peter Laviolette versus John Hines in multiple categories to try to figure out if there were improvements or the team regressed in certain areas. And one conclusion I came to is, it would not be a stretch to say that the majority of the Predators' success in the second half of the season after the coaching change was largely due to UC Soros. If he does not play as well as he does, I'm not sure the Predators are in the position that they're in when the season was paused, which was the second wild card spot in the Western Conference. Could they have made the playoffs in the 2014 format? Yes, but they would not have been number 6. I think UC Soros deserves a lot of credit for the Predators being where they were and having the 16-11-1 record they had under John Hines during the regular season. So that gives me confidence. The postseason, it's sort of a wash. It wasn't great, but I'm not swayed negatively by his performance. So I'll say a 6, close to the middle, but leaning more towards optimism.
I'd probably go 6.5 or a 7. I agree with a lot of what you said, and there have been times on this show where I have doubted UC Soros and the fact that whether or not he's the guy moving forward beyond Pecorine back when he was, you know, clearly the backup. And now it's close to him being clearly the starter. And look, the postseason was, I'd say, average for UC Soros. There were some pucks that you wish that he would have stopped in hindsight. Maybe the Grabner shorthanded goal, tough to get on him for a breakaway shorthanded with one of the top penalty killers / shorthanded specialist in Michael Grabner. Hard to get on him for that. The Connor Garland goal, maybe if he plays that differently, he stops that puck. It was a great play by Garland. Probably the Taylor Hall goal on the power play where he looked like he was a little slow getting over to that side of the crease to stop that puck. And maybe the second goal in which he kind of looked, you know, discombobulated before Phil Kessel made it 2-0. But I think in large part we are nitpicking there, and that he has become almost a, and I've used this word a lot, but he's almost become the pinata of a lot of Preds fans on Twitter because he wasn't Pecorine.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it was such a debate and people were so split on that decision. I mean, a lot of people were yes Soros, a lot of people were yes Pecorine, and the people who were the latter are pinning this on Soros because we never saw Pecorine mm-hmm. in net for the Nashville Predators. So I think he still has a lot of potential. I do think he needs to get better and more consistent, especially to start seasons. I think when he starts so slow, like he has in a couple of the seasons in the last couple of years, when he does that, I think that puts a seed of doubt in people's heads of whether or not he can be the full-time guy and start 60 or 70 games a year.
Mm-hmm. I understand that.
And play at a high level.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something he will need to improve upon, especially if, as we assume, he will be starting the season next year as the number one goaltender.
And another thing he's going to have to face, like it or not, is when he does become the official starter, and it has probably already happened, is that he is always going to be compared to Pecorine, whether or not 35 is sitting on the bench or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that, we've seen in sports, can be a tough act to follow when you're following a legend. And Pecorine, while he may not be a Hall of Fame goaltender in the National Hockey League, he's a Hall of Famer in Smashville. I mean, he is a legend in this city, the face of the franchise for basically a decade. And Saros is going to have to combat that, maybe not individually, but a lot of Preds fans are going to be comparing Saros to Rene for years to come.
For multiple reasons, not just because he succeeded Pecorine, but, you know, their friendship is a big part of this. I mean, that's one thing that John Hines one of the things that John Hines said during training camp that I thought was quite interesting was when asked about the relationship between the two of them, because that was obviously a topic of conversation, he said it was unlike anything he's ever seen in his career, the relationship between Pecorine and UC Saros. You know, they're both Finns. Pekka has taken UC brought UC into his home. They care about each other a great deal, not just as teammates. So that's going to play into it as well. And UC's not in it's a tough situation. I mean, you're replacing, as you said, a franchise legend. So, you know, he will always be compared to Pecorine for a very long time. But I think what this postseason confirmed, which we sort of already knew during the 4 to 5 months that we didn't have hockey, is that UC Saros has succeeded Pecorine as the number one goaltender of the Nashville Predators. It's done.
Adam Vigan of The Athletic, thank you as always for coming in and hanging out here on Preds Insiders.
Always a pleasure, Ryan. Thank you for having me.
For Adam Vingan, I'm Ryan Poore. Thank you for listening to this edition of Preds Insiders. Coming up next year on ESPN 102.5 The Game, or I should say at 7:15, it is coverage of Nashville SC taking on FC Dallas in their return to play for Major League Soccer. That is coming up at 7:15 on both 102.5 The Game and ESPN 94.9. We'll talk to you next Monday on Preds Insiders, ESPN 102.5 The Game.